Start the recording. Chair, the meeting
Okay.
is yours.
And we do have a quorum? Erica, we do have a quorum, correct?
Oh, yes, Chair, you
Okay.
do. And we will bring in Councilmember Keaton. I see her.
Okay, great.
Never mind. Councilmember Jonathan is here. Never mind. Yes, you have a quorum.
Okay, great. Okay, we'll call a meeting to order. Erica, you'll do roll call.
Yes, good morning, committee members. Agua Caliente, City of Blythe, City of Cathedral City.
Present.
City of Coachella, Desert Healthcare District. City of Desert Hot Springs.
Here.
City of Indian Wells.
Here.
City of Indio.
Here.
City of La Quinta.
Here.
City of Palm Desert.
Present.
City of Palm Springs.
Here.
Oh, just joined. City of Rancho Mirage.
Here.
And Riverside County.
Here.
Chair, you have a quorum.
Great. Thank you. We'll move on to public comment. Erica, is there any public comment?
Chair, we did not receive any written comments, and I do not see any hands raised at this time.
Okay, great. Thank you. We'll move on to committee staff announcements. Any staff announcements, Erica?
Just draw your attention. Some of you may have seen the news over the summer, and there is a written update. The funding did come through for the Navigation Center in the city of Palm Springs. This is something you all have been briefed on over the months, and there is a status update as well as a news release that was released by both the county and the city. Congratulations to both of them for the hard work in getting the funding secured from the state. And for the record, I would also note that Director Rogers from the Desert Healthcare District has joined us.
Great. Thank you. Any comments from the committee? Any announcements?
I got a quick one if you don't mind. I just wanted to give a big shout out to Greg Rodriguez and two officers, Brooks and Powell's. We had encountered a homeless veteran this summer, and with the backing of Greg Pettis, we were able to place him in the New Cathedral City veterans housing. It took a lot of doing. It took a lot of phone calls, but I can't praise Greg. He took all the calls. He made it happen, and the two officers got involved. So we have a 80 plus year old gentleman who lost his housing, and now he's got permanent housing. So the system does work, and we're just very excited that that happened. Thank you, Greg. Really appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thanks, Mark.
Great news, and congratulations, Greg. Any others?
Mr. Chair,
if not, we'll move. I'm sorry?
If I might give a brief, very brief report. Thank you. Thank you. So at the last Riverside County Continuum of Care Board of Governance meeting, that's the entity that allocates the funding that it receives from HUD to various parts of Riverside County, we learned that the COC has been approved for approximately $13 million, and it's sending through our application. And hopefully, I expect some of that funding will come towards the Coachella Valley. There is a lot of funding coming our way towards homelessness. So, Greg, I don't know if you'll add more to that in your report, but I just wanted to share a little bit of good news with the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If I could just tag on to that, Mr. Chair,
sure.
We actually had the results of the elections, too, for individuals on the Board of Governance. And we always worry that we're going to lose seats out of the Valley. That wasn't the case. Actually, William Hutchinson, we call him Hutch, from the Palm Springs Police Department, was elected to that seat. Anise Smith, who you all know from CV Housing First, was also elected to that seat. And then Linda Barak, who I think everybody on this call knows. So really, really great representation on the Board of Governance. So.
Great. Good news is always a welcome.
And Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I will have to leave about 20 minutes to 10, according to how this meeting goes, but I'll be doing some driving time, so I'll sign off, and then with my computer skills, I'll try to get back on in the vehicle. So,
okay, great.
Thank you. Thank you.
Chair, I'd just like to note for the record, the member from Agua Caliente is also here, Councilmember Preckwinkle.
I saw John. Welcome, John. Okay, we'll move on to the consent calendar. If there are no corrections or nobody wants to pull anything, I'll entertain a motion for approval.
Move to approve.
Second.
Motion and second. Erica, do we have to do a roll call, or can we just raise our hand and say aye?
You can raise your hand and say aye.
All in favor, please raise your hand and say aye.
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 Motion aye, carries aye. Unanimously.
Elaine Holmes has to abstain, just for the record. Sorry.
Okay, with one abstention.
And are there any noes?
Thank you. I think I might need to abstain from the minutes since I was not at that meeting.
Okay. Councilmember Gardner as well. Okay, we'll move on to item number 6A, a discussion. It's the update on the revenue stream feasibility study for affordable housing and associated transportation needs. And Peter, you're going to give that staff report.
Absolutely. Well, good morning, Mr. Vice Chair, fellow committee members. Before we dive into the update for this project, I do want to provide just a little bit of context. As you may recall, this is one of two projects CVAG is undertaking with our regional early action planning program funding, as provided by the Southern California Association of Governments, aka SCAG. The other project that we're applying funding towards is the implementation of an affordable housing catalyst fund as implemented by Lift to Rise and identified through their affordable housing collaborative action network. This is providing capital subsidies, operational subsidies, and loans to stimulate affordable housing production, and to date has provided financing for pre-development work on over 600 units. So good work going on there. The project we have before us today really kicked off January 2022, and we presented some initial findings from a survey of available funding mechanisms both within the Coachella Valley and the greater state of California to this committee last April, as well as conducted a few stakeholder outreach sessions over the course of the summer. And over the last few months, we've been hard at work conducting a quantitative analysis of some of the more promising revenue tools we've identified, and incorporating some of the feedback we've gotten from this committee, as well as some of our stakeholders, into that analysis of funding availability and policy initiatives. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Joe Diegas, Senior Vice President with Cosmon Companies, and Stevie Espinoza, Senior Project Coordinator with Ariano Associates, who will provide a update on the progress to date and next steps. I believe we have a PowerPoint.
Thank you. Okay, before we begin, are there any questions of staff? Okay, if not, Joe, I don't know who's going to take it, Joe or Stevie first.
Joe will take it. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. Joe Diegas here from Cosmon. So we're pleased to provide you an update. If folks may remember, our project has various components. As Peter mentioned, some of our early work was about surveying what tools are already existing in the CVAG region, what's already being used for housing and transportation supportive infrastructure. So in that same process, we were drafting an engagement plan led by our partners at Ariano Associates, represented by Stevie today, about how we would stay in contact with the various committees at CVAG and other stakeholders. Where we've been up to in this past, I guess, 5 months or so, 4 to 5 months, is putting more meat on the bone, so to speak, more quantitative analysis of the various tools that we may have discussed back in April, and also some supporting policy initiatives. So not just quantitative funding and financing mechanisms, but policies that support those mechanisms. Where we will go from here, ideally, with this committee's direction and guidance, is more stakeholder engagement and actually putting together a regional strategic plan, a document with even more meat on the bone than what you've seen in the attachments of the staff report, with direction on how this could proceed forward mechanically, with timing, administrative steps, whatever further outreach is required, meant to be a full roadmap to actually implement the tools. As mentioned, we're in this quantitative analysis stage, policy initiative stage. We have done some stakeholder engagement, but it will continue. So I've highlighted a few of the components here. I'd like to be a little bit more specific about it. Our roadmap outline consists of a few different components. We'll spend some time today talking about quantitative, ongoing, sustainable revenues, not just, we get lucky with a grant here or there, or we're able to get some fee revenue here or there, but ongoing, sustainable revenues on an annual, ongoing basis. We do indeed also look at some of those one-time sources, such as grants, such as fee programs, other things like that. As mentioned, policies that can support those types of tools that increase their political or quantitative viability, their financial viability in parallel. And then further, the specific tools that kind of bundle all of those things together and actually make them implementable both on a local and regional scale within the CVAG region. And our intention is to memorialize and bundle all those components together in our ultimate deliverable, this regional strategic plan, consistent with our scope of work. One of the main tools that was identified in our ongoing sustainable revenue category is tax increment financing. We heard very clearly from our early stakeholders is, how can you generate ongoing sustainable revenues without increasing taxes on landowners, on businesses, on residents? And so that led us to a primary mechanism in tax increment financing. Members of this committee may be very familiar. We'd just like to do a quick review. These districts allow a jurisdiction or group of jurisdictions to draw a boundary. It can be within a community, it can be within multiple communities, it can be an entire community. And within that boundary, at the time of district formation, our assessed property values are frozen in time, so to speak. What then happens is over time, as new development happens, as redevelopment of underutilized properties happens, there's an increase in assessed value. And what can then happen is some portion of the future property taxes from that new development, from that increased value, can be put aside in a special purpose entity, some form of tax increment financing district with a special purpose, infrastructure, affordable housing, transportation. And for some period of time, those dollars will be dedicated on an ongoing sustainable basis. Up until such time that that district terminates, there's flexibility on how that termination deadline is defined. And after such time, all the revenues go back to normal, so to speak. The dollars get distributed back to cities, county, other taxing entities, just the way they were before the district was formed. There are a few different alternatives for tax increment financing in California. As folks are probably very well familiar, redevelopment agencies were dissolved in 2012. And what we've seen are a few different tools be introduced since 2014. The first one, what is probably most familiar to members of this committee in the region, are enhanced infrastructure financing districts, or EIFs. Folks may be familiar with community revitalization and investment authorities, or CREAs. There are several variations of EIFs, tools that NIFTY is the acronym, Neighborhood Infill Transit and Infill Finance and Transit Improvements Act. I did not make these up, I apologize. And then there's another one, NIFTY 2, another variation of NIFTY, with some nuances on how the dollars can be utilized and how the boundaries get formed. Just a few comments. We don't spend a ton of time at Cosmont in our work around the state in evaluating either of the NIFTYs. They have requirements such as the district has to be coterminous with a city limit or a county limit, and other requirements about how the dollars that can be spent that in our experience has made them infeasible in most of the communities we've evaluated. And while community revitalization and investment authorities, or the CREAs, are sort of a more housing-focused EIFD, there is a yet more focused housing version called the Affordable Housing Authorities, AHAs, which on one end of the spectrum do not allow any investment into infrastructure of any sort, transportation or otherwise, but would dedicate funding exclusively for affordable housing uses. Because of those restrictions, we often see many of our communities wanting to do more than one thing, more than just affordable housing, transportation infrastructure, other things. And because of that restriction, much of the time we're focusing most on EIFDs and CREAs, and in circumstances where we're focused more so on infrastructure than just on affordable housing, we're often ending up evaluating and implementing EIFDs. So various flavors, the tax increment in California. Many of these are being formed. We're up to about 21 TIF districts formed post-redevelopment in the state of California. they're also different. We could talk about case studies if the committee would like in Q&A, but you know, our closest one formed in the region is an unincorporated Riverside County, Wine Country EISD, and they vary in terms of housing focus versus TO, transit-oriented development focus. Sometimes it's just basic water sewer infrastructure focus, and they vary highly. So to bring it home here in the CVAG region, we looked at, of course, the various incorporated jurisdictions within the CVAG region. We additionally looked at the unincorporated communities as part of the CVAG region for purposes of evaluating special district funding capacity. There was a lot of work within just the district boundaries on how one jurisdiction or a group of jurisdictions could draw one of these TIF district boundaries within their own jurisdiction. And there's a lot of methodology described in the appendix to this report, and there will be even more detail in the ultimate regional strategic plan. But at a high level, what we've done is looked at different scenarios of how much of an individual community would be placed into one of these districts on a percentage basis. So a city has, let's say, 100% of its acreage or 100% of its assessed value. We're assuming, let's say in one scenario, what if the city decided to put 50% of its entire jurisdiction into one of these TIF districts? And over time, from the growth of that 50% of the city, just a portion, just 5% of the future property tax increment revenues from within that boundary were set aside into the special purpose TIF district to make sure there is funding set aside, like a retirement account for affordable housing and infrastructure. That is just one scenario that we looked at. Another scenario evaluated was, okay, what if the city put, or the county or the unincorporated community, put 25% of its jurisdiction into one of these districts? And perhaps with the smaller portion of the city put into this district, perhaps that community could afford to contribute a higher level, 25% of the future property tax increment. No other revenues, just a property tax increment from within that boundary into one of these special purpose entities, again, to set aside funding for affordable housing and infrastructure. And in a yet further scenario, what if a city put yet less, 10% of its community into one of these districts, but perhaps with that smaller boundary, perhaps that community could afford, so to speak, to put a higher percentage of the future revenues, the future property tax revenues within that district into one of these communities. These are just three, consider them placeholders, please. Ultimately, we would expect each community to very creatively and strategically define what the boundary looks like, but we find these sort of placeholder examples to be quite informative on how many dollars do we get to? How many dollars are we actually talking about to fund projects? So in that first scenario, over an example, 50-year district lifetime across the various CVAG cities and unincorporated communities, over 50 years, we're talking about $344 million in this scenario. Those are in sort of nominal dollars, current dollars, doesn't really account for inflation or anything like that. When we do account for inflation and the time value of money, what that really means is about $137 million of funding capacity to pay for projects, affordable housing and transportation. With that scenario B, it takes a pretty big uptick, $860 million in nominal dollars, $343 million in present value dollars. And in that last scenario C, it falls somewhere in between, $688 million in nominal dollars, $274 million in present value dollars. We prefer to talk in present value dollars in terms of what you can really fund today. So there's this range between these scenarios in present value dollars, depending on how the district is drawn, the boundaries are drawn within each jurisdiction, and how much percent of future revenues are dedicated. We've got this range of $137 to $343 million in present value terms. Again, there's a lot that goes into the assumption for the purpose of this presentation. We don't have all of the detail, but the attached attachments to the staff report have a lot of the detail. So that is just a form of sustainable ongoing revenue. It would never be intended to be the only source of revenue. And it's for that purpose that we spend a good bit of time on complementary funding. So as you'll see perhaps in the attachment, we look at various sources, state and federal grants that align very well with these proposed uses of affordable housing and transportation. We've selected a few, we've detailed them in the attachment. Roughly speaking, $20 to $265 million in grant programs that we see very clearly aligned with these goals. We additionally look at these housing linkage fees that, of course, are completely at the discretion of the local jurisdiction. These are the fees where, you know, something like industrial development can pay a per square foot or per acreage fee, and that would enable CVAG as a region or a local community to set aside funding for affordable housing. Housing and LU fees, more and more communities in the CVAG region are evaluating this tool. It's the idea that if you're not putting affordable housing within a project, a developer or a group of developers may contribute a fee in lieu of that affordable housing on site, and those dollars can be bundled. We've talked a bit in previous conversations about what we call this development opportunity reserve or community benefit concept, where either density or FAR or building height or setback requirements, sort of planning incentives, are allotted to specific projects that contribute a community benefit, and oftentimes that community benefit is affordable housing. It doesn't have to be. Public finance liquidity strategies, as detailed in the attachments, we're talking about certain jurisdictions. This is very jurisdiction by jurisdiction specific, where there is outstanding debt, for example, that can be refinanced to lower rates, though it is becoming increasingly difficult in today's rate environment. We still include a discussion about how that translates into funding for housing and transportation infrastructure. And then our last part, a hot topic today, always happy to talk about this with members of the committee today or offline, a monetization of public agency assets, whether it's through sale or ground lease or other monetization assets, how those can generate funding for housing and transportation infrastructure. And we've got to make a special shout out and make sure everyone continues to be aware of Surplus Land Act at the state level and the requirements of that for cities and counties to dispose of land. So there's greater discussion on all those things. Wrapping up here, potential supportive policies. So again, we talk about policies that support those revenue tools. Some of the ones that we wanted to highlight that are in alignment with established programs, such as HCD's pro-housing designation guideline, various tools like density bonus programs that exceed the statutory density bonus law, oftentimes allow a community or group of communities to be more competitive, especially for state grants. Another one of those specifically recommended are one-stop shop permitting process adopted at the jurisdiction level. Reduction of DIF, development impact fees for specific land use types, specifically residential and or specific household types, is a specific policy that the state recognizes as a designation of pro-housing policy. Pre-approved or pro-housing prototype plans. We've seen some of this in the area, specifically for what they call the missing middle housing types. Think things like duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes in low density single family areas. What's explicitly called out in some of these guidelines is the establishment of an EIFE or similar local financing tool. The state, as one example, recognizes that that's a designation of pro-housing policy and increases competitiveness for grants based on that alone. Grants or low interest loans for ADUs, accessory dwelling units, or other affordable housing, these are potential supportive policies. Housing subsidy pools, local or regional trust funds, we throw in catalyst funds, similar funding sources like that. Not only do they generate funding on their own, or at least serve as mechanisms, but they additionally increase competitiveness for grants, especially at the state level, explicitly. Just some examples, there are more in the attachments, but just some of those that called out to us as particularly relevant to CVAG and particularly relevant to these goals of affordable housing and transportation. So again, the goal ultimately with the feedback from this committee and other stakeholder outreach is to bundle all these components together, memorialize it in a detailed plan. How do you actually go out and do this? With timing, the administrative steps, more specificity on dollar amounts. We're happy to look at different scenarios at the discretion of this committee or future conversations, and bringing it all together. For a moment, I did want to pass over to Stevie to talk a little bit about what the stakeholder engagement has been so far and where it potentially goes from here. So I'd ask Stevie to chime in, please.
Thanks, Joe. Hello, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Stevie Espinoza with Ariano Associates. And today I'll be reviewing the remainder of the outreach schedule and provide a recap of the first community meeting. So we are nearing the halfway point of the engagement plan. We had a great first community meeting in June where we introduced the study and reviewed the tools under consideration. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. Our second community meeting is scheduled for next month on October 13th. and we're going to be asking the attendees for their feedback on potential revenue tools and some of the alternatives. The final community meeting is going to be held June of next year for project wrap and conclusions. And we'll also brief the executive committee and meet with you again in the spring. Before the next two community meetings, we'll implement the toolkit outreach period as we did before in June. And this is where we would send key stakeholders and community leaders the extended outreach toolkit that has shareable text and graphics that can be posted to all major social media platforms, newsletters, and e-blasts. And now I want to quickly recap the first community meeting that was held earlier this summer. We had great representation from a variety of stakeholder groups, including 7 from public agencies, 8 from nonprofits, and 2 from developer groups. Our group was also very knowledgeable about some of the meeting topics already. And at the beginning of the presentation, we learned they were already familiar with a few of the tools we were presenting on, including impact fees, the housing-related grants, and zoning incentives. Meeting attendees also let us know they were most interested in promoting housing production and community enhancement, economic opportunities for the region. At the end of the meeting, we asked attendees which potential revenue tools were they most interested in for further evaluation. So we went through each of the tools and asked them again, which were they most interested in? The top 3, as you see on your screen here, were inclusionary housing policies, housing-related grants, and sustainability districts. So we had great representation and engagement from all the attendees at the first meeting, and we are going to start the outreach process soon for the next meeting in October. So if you know of any stakeholders or stakeholder groups that we need to be reaching out to, we would definitely welcome your input. So thank you very much. And with that, I'll pass off to Joe, who will discuss the next steps.
Joe, I think you're muted.
Apologies, Chair. Thank you. So our next step is to most importantly get questions, get feedback from this committee, and then incorporate that into our further work here. We continue our engagement, stakeholder engagement, as Stevie said, our next community meeting coming up here in October. And then ultimately to wrap up in a more formal document, the regional strategic plan. Our goal is to draft that over the coming months, have a good working draft by April, for presentations to this committee and other groups, and to ultimately have that adopted in the ideal scenario by the end of June of 2023. That really concludes our presentation. Thank you all for bearing with us. We'd love to hear any questions, comments. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Joe and Stevie. Any comments at this time? Either from staff or the committee.
Yeah. Mr. Chair or Vice Chair, if I might.
Sure.
Thank you. First of all, congratulations. That's a very comprehensive and I think very good presentation and a good piece of work. And I think you're definitely headed in the right direction. So thank you for that. Just you asked for feedback. So I'll tell you that personally, I'm not keen on a funding solution that involves taxes or if you want to use euphemism, fees. I would see that as problematic, especially in light of the abundant funding that is coming through from the state, from federal to a lesser degree, through HUD and so forth, as I mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, that we are fortunately the recipients of. So I think to impose fees or taxes to create revenue for homelessness is in my mind, a non-starter. And I'm just speaking for myself in terms of the feedback that you asked for. I do think that there are other alternatives for sustainable revenues. So I would hope that the ultimate report focuses on that. The other observation that I would make very quickly is that in terms of supportive policies, the individual cities in the Coachella Valley have, I think, pretty much had enough of the erosion of local control. So I think we each like to make our own decisions about those kinds of policies, whether it's density bonuses that exceed the state mandates or other such policies. So in the report, while I think it's important to present alternatives, I wouldn't want you to proceed with the assumption that there's a one size fits all for the Coachella Valley. I think our cities each enjoy our own independence and our own ability to make the decision that's right for our city and our residents. And finally, you didn't mention specific stakeholders, but when it comes to like a housing trust fund, you know, that's exactly what Lift to Rise has. So I assume you've explored, you know, the other stakeholders and service providers in the Coachella Valley, many of which are doing an amazing and excellent job that I think can be very much a part of this process. Sorry to be so long-winded. Thank you.
No, excellent comments, Savvy. And yes, I would just like to say, too, that I think this committee in the past has not supported any kind of taxes going forward. So I'm glad that we're looking at other alternatives. And we were not supportive. And I think that's kind of what got us here today, because we wanted to explore other alternatives. So I would agree with your comments. Anybody else? Okay, if not, Erica, the recommendation, is there a motion for the recommendation from staff?
There's no need for a vote.
Just informational?
We were just looking for some feedback. It sounds like we have received some feedback. So thank you for that. And with that, we can hand off part two of Peter's REAP update with item.
REAP 2.0. Yeah.
Well, good morning again, committee members. So hot on the heels of our REAP 2019 work is the publishing of many REAP 2.0 guidelines. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about what we're looking ahead towards in terms of REAP 2.0. And it's same, but different, one could say. There's lots of same focuses here in this program, but there's also an emphasis on some additional active transportation work, which is novel to this second iteration of REAP. So the focus of REAP 2.0 is really to target transformative planning and implementation activities. The state has kind of interpreted this to mean projects must hit all of the three following criteria: one, accelerating infill development; two, affirmatively further fair housing; and three, reduce vehicle miles traveled, also known as VMT. So that last point, that is really a novel introduction to the whole REAP milieu, if you will. So obviously this money is again being channeled through SCAG, and SCAG has identified three primary programming buckets that they will be dispersing this funding through. The first bucket is early action initiatives. This includes funding for programs like Sustainable Communities Program, the Local Information Services and Regional Data Platform, and Go Human programs, all of which are kind of SCAG projects. But there's also a carve out for the Sub-Regional Partnership Program 2.0, which I'll talk about in just a little bit. The second bucket of funding is the County Transportation Commission Partnership Program. This will be a program where SCAG is funneling money to our regional transportation commissions to apply towards transit and other multimodal services that reduce VMT. And projects here can include plans, programs, and pilot projects that all serve to kind of promote community connection through means other than motorized vehicles. The final programming bucket is what SCAG is calling Housing Supportive Infrastructure Program. This is designed to support infrastructure and utilities that will further grow at housing development, preservation of existing affordable housing, the implementation of housing trust funds, and then obviously technical assistance for the any of the above. So let's go back a step to this sub-regional partnership program. This is one of the programs that SCAG has finalized guidelines for. These have been passed and adopted by the regional council earlier this month. This is a non-competitive allocation to councils of government within the SCAG region. CBAG, being a council of government, is has the opportunity to apply for up to $541,975, which is a little bit less than we got during REAP 2019, but is pretty close. So under this sub-regional partnership program, SCAG is prioritizing mostly the implementation of housing elements, six cycle housing elements to be exact, as well as programs that would otherwise qualify under this housing supportive infrastructure program. There's a few timelines to keep in mind here as CBAC considers applying for this fund, these funds. The first is October 14th, when we need to notify SCAG that we are intending to apply. And the final due date for applications is February 10th. Luckily, the October 10 notification doesn't require any sort of specific project outline. It's mostly just like, you know, we want to apply for the fund. We think we're going to apply for it under this project. And we don't need any sort of committee approval for that. But for the final February 10th application, obviously we need to have a pretty robust scope of work, as well as approval from the governing body here at CBAG. So we are intending to submit a notice for intent to fund, just so we can kind of reserve those funds and discuss potential projects with some of our stakeholders, jurisdictions, partner groups over the next couple months. And we'll, of course, if we generate any of those programs, we will bring them back to the Homelessness Committee for discussion. With all that being said, though, it is worth noting that REAP 1.0 funding has not come without its administrative difficulties. We've spent extensive staff time coordinating with SCAG to get projects approved, to get contracts approved, to get consultants approved. And this is an experience I've shared with both our implementation partners within the CBAG region and across the SCAG region. So there's a little bit of hesitancy on behalf of CBAG staff to apply for these funds, given the administrative challenges that it will entail to actually implement the projects. However, should CBAG choose to pass on all these funds, the entirety of the $541,000 would move to the Housing Supportive Infrastructure Grant Program. Those guidelines for that program are still under development, so I can't really tell you exactly what projects will qualify there, and applications there will be competitive. However, the money that CBAG has passed up will at least be earmarked for use within the CBAG region. So if partners or jurisdictions have eligible projects, they would get first dibs, as it were, at the money that CBAG otherwise would have been had access to. So there is still an opportunity to get the money that is dedicated for this region. Outside of the SRP program, we are also just keeping an eye on some of the other funding buckets that SCAG has identified. We've had some informal conversations with RCTC about a few potential CBAG active transportation programs that could potentially make their way into the RCTC funding application. And we're waiting to hear back about the results of those. So that's kind of where we stand today. I'd happily entertain any questions regarding REAP 2.0 funding or any project ideas or input from this committee.
Questions for Peter? I do have a question. So even if we were to decide to pass on these funds because of the difficulty in dealing with some of the issues that you raised, we would still have a seat at the table with some of the other organizations that would still be involved, correct? So we'd still have input.
My understanding.
I see Greg shaking his head yes. So that's that's exactly what I wanted to find out.
Right. And so part of the guideline setting for this Housing Supportive Infrastructure Program will identify who the eligible applicants are for program funding. And so I don't want to equivocally state that we'll be able to apply for those, but I mean, I think the intention is that local agencies, partner agencies, and the like will be able to tap into those funds.
If I can add on, Mr. Chair, is sure. A little context in history is that Lift to Rise in their Catalyst Fund operation actually approached the state and Eduardo last year on a direct budget ask, but the priorities of the assemblyman, and rightly so, were at the $30 million ask for OASIS. With that being said, it was the intention of the legislature and the governor's office to allocate some dollars within REAP 2.0 that would specifically fund a catalyst point. And that language is in there. So even if we weren't to go after this $500,000, and Peter, we'll have a conversation offline about some possible chances of that. But there is going to be the potential for a significant allocation to partners here in the Valley, such as Lift to Rise in the county on the Catalyst Fund. Additionally, too, as I sat in on the meeting yesterday on the update, and I believe Peter, sounds like you were on, that I think a huge potential for infrastructure dollars in the East Valley as well through the infrastructure portion of that as well.
Okay. Thank you. Savvy, you have your hand raised.
Yes, sir. So
I apologize. This is a little bit out of left field, but I'm looking at this report, and it feels a little bit like, you know, getting money to do planning for planning, you know, and it occurs to me that, you know, $540,000 will actually buy two condominiums in Indian Creek Villas, a condo complex up 74 in Palm Desert. And if we can buy housing units, two bedrooms suitable for families or two separate individuals, if we can buy units for $270,000 each in Palm Desert, I'm guessing we can buy them for that amount or possibly even less in some of our other communities. And this also relates back, I told you it's out of left field, but it also relates back to your last report. When can we start applying for money to you know, have an inventory of housing units available for our homelessness program? I would love, you know, our city of Palm Desert owns and operates 1,200 low income units, housing units. Mm-hmm. Why can't CVAG start assembling an inventory of housing that is available for the homeless, the Coachella Valley homelessness program? And that's going to feed into the CARE Act, which Greg is going to talk about. So, you know, I'd love to see funding that is not planning for planning, but instead results in real tangible results, such as housing units, which, let's face it, folks, is one of the obstacles to addressing homelessness. So I don't know if Peter or Greg, is that even in the on radar? Is it even in a possibility, or am I completely, as I said, out of left field? Thank you.
No, and I totally agree with you on the planning for planning's sake. I'm so sick and tired of planning dollars. And originally, that's what 1.0 was supposed to be, was about the planning, and 2.0 about implementation. And we're actually spending almost a year on 2.0 just to figure out what the guidelines are. So there is frustration. This gets into the bureaucracy with SCAG. And it's not really staff's fault. It's just kind of how they operate. But to your point, Savvy, is, you know, Eric and I have had these conversations with their team, and it's serious discussion now at the county level, especially going after the HAP round three and HAP four monies that will keep coming, about the actual acquisition of property, specifically for targeted programs like the CV200 program. There's also other replicas that are going on throughout the county. And so, you know, there's a lot of just logistics around that, about, you know, holding title and operations and all that. But to your point is, we know the stock is low, and how do we start utilizing some of these dollars to actually provide those individual units for specific homeless programming outside of the larger efforts to build, you know, comprehensive affordable housing developments.
I couldn't agree more. It almost sounds like we're starting to get in that salt and sea predicament. You know, we have a ton of planning dollars, and we've been planning for 20 or 30 years, and yet we're still planning. So
that's what I keep telling people. I mean, we have a strategic action plan for the county. You guys know all the work I did on the collaborative efforts and stuff. We know what the issue is. We know what we need. Just mm-hmm. give us the dollars and let us start buying it. So.
Yeah, we could easily do that. You know, in our own communities, we can come up with our own regional approach. Just give us the money. We can go out and find the places.
From a CVAG staff perspective, if our boss was on, if we had given him audio controls and promoted him to panelists, you would have heard his whole soapbox. He couldn't agree more. It's actually the first question that we got asked when 2.0 came out. We are looking for those same opportunities, as Greg mentioned, both in partnership with the county and some other options. And hopefully we'll be bringing some of those forward. But we certainly need units. And Mayor Pro Temp, your comment is not out of left field. It's exactly where CVAG staff is looking as well. We need to find more doors.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Erica. And don't elevate Tom, please.
Any other comments for staff? If not, this is informational, and we'll move on to item C, which is an update from Greg. So, Greg, we'll move into your update.
Yeah, and hopefully, Erica, this is going to work for me.
Greg, you should be able to move your own slides. If not, we will advance them.
Yeah, you're going to have to advance. My arrows are for some reason not working. So, all right. Just a little bit of background. As Mayor Pro Tem Jonathan brought up, it's been a few months ago, about how can we look into other creative ways and alternative ways to get individuals, in specifically those that have high mental health and substance use acuity issues, into treatment, in a way, some kind of compelling them into treatment. At that time, this actually been more than a few months ago, it's almost probably been a year ago, as the city of Sacramento was looking into such a type of program. There were a lot of logistical issues with the city, and basically they kind of stepped back because the governor stepped up and decided to propose this Community Assistance Recovery and Empowerment Court program. And so we had the subcommittee, the collaborative subcommittee met, and I did this presentation. As most of you know, this was signed by the governor last week. There was a lot of reiterations within the legislature addressing primarily some real concerns that counties, believe it or not, and CSAC had on implementation and the possibility of another unfunded mandate. So the committee decided to have me come and present to the whole committee. And Eric, I'm sure we'll share the presentation once we're done. It's heavily worded, and I know that CVAC, especially Tom, doesn't like heavily worded presentations, but I wanted to make sure that the information is in here. Some of it is repetitive, so I'll go over that. So I'll try to get through this as quickly as possible, but to really explain what the system is. So this kind of outlines what the pathway is. And what I want to do is make two distinctions. As many of you know, the county about 4 months ago implemented what we call our home court. And that mirrors like our veterans court, our family preservation court. And what the home court does is specifically address individuals that are tied to the justice system. So those that have been arrested, those that have been incarcerated, but they have to have a linkage to the justice system. Already highly successful and under implementation as well. The care court pathway is for individuals. They can be tied to the justice system, but they don't have to be. So what you'll see is the pathway here, and I'm going to get into some of these in a little more detail as we move on. But you'll have a referral system. What's different about the referral process in care court, unlike, say, a conservatorship where you need a behavioral health, mental health professional to refer, is this can be done by family members. It can be done by therapists. It can be done by community members for a referral type process. Once we get into a referral happens, then it goes to the courts for to order a clinical evaluation, which is done by the behavioral health departments within the county. If it's determined that individual qualifies for the program, a care program is set up. And again, I'll get into some little more details in the future. And then there's also continued ongoing support. They call it a support person, but it's basically a case manager for all intents and purposes, and ideally, hopefully, lending itself to success. It's also important to keep in mind this is all based on a housing first model. So as we know in this committee, that's proven to be quite successful within our program, and we believe is a key in the court pathway system. Erica, next slide, please. So again, I kind of went over what care court is. You know, this is a huge paradigm shift in the state. It is looking at how we get around the challenges that we have in getting individuals into care. Obviously, I was on another call about this, and that we're kind of going back and fixing what we did in the 80s and eliminating a lot of what our mental health care facilities were in the state. You can keep going on. The care court is aiming to deliver behavioral health services, especially to the most vulnerable individuals as well. And you can keep going on the next two, Erica. This is an upstream diversion program, and it's meant to be less restrictive than, say, a conservatorship or incarceration. Both of those are highly costly, and so we're hoping that this system will not only be more cost effective, but again, not as restrictive and really utilizing the housing first and full wraparound services approach. And again, this is evidence based on the housing first and wraparound care services. You can go to the next slide, Erica. This just goes a little bit on the referral side. You can advance on, again, for those that have untreated schizophrenia, really high acuity mental health issues, many with co-occurring on the substance use. Again, it lists here, of course, family members, behavioral health providers, first responders as well. Again, hopefully providing another tool for our public safety agencies. As I said, the civil court will order a clinical evaluation, through the behavioral health departments, and then the court will review that clinical evaluation and determine if the client is eligible for the program. You can move on, Erica. Perfect. And then again, a care plan is established. This is a lot like what we do in CV 200. Is once a client will qualify for the program, We will work very closely with our behavioral health department, with the district attorney's office, public defender in the court system, and then as well as assigning a case manager to that individual to develop not only a care plan for behavioral and substance use treatment, but for housing, and then, of course, ongoing support as well. And again, the support section is a lot what we do with intense case management. One thing to note here, too, is that there will be a mental health advance directive, and that's done for any future crises. What we experience a lot in the field, and not just the CV 200 program, but other programs through the county, is a lot of times we can't really get a mental diagnosis in order to get somebody into housing. And so if we're identifying this situation up front in the care court process, is that if we find that individual again through our homeless management information system, HMIS, or through the coordinated entry system, we should have that advance directive on file, which will assist in further placement. And then obviously we're all hoping for success. So this is going to be one of the hardest things to measure in this program. Again, because it's new, because it's a paradigm shift. But again, I think we can take a lot of the data that we've done in the county on around our housing first models, our rapid rehousing and permit supportive housing to really determine some good metrics on how we're doing this as well. I think the other advantage too is because it's a court program, and because the relationship is so integrated with behavioral health, we already do that within our family preservation courts, our drug courts, and our veterans courts. So we kind of have that process of tracking that data and in order to do that. Next slide. Again, this is just a clinical criteria. I'm just going to skip over this as again, it's the acute mental health needs. And then, Erica, if care court is not for everyone experiencing homeless, I want to make this quite clear in that for those that really maybe have mild behavioral health issues or just substance use issues, they will not qualify for this. We go on to the next count. This again, Erica, you can advance, is just a recap of what the components of the community referral are, the stabilization and medication, and then of course implementing a housing plan as well. You can go to the next full slide, Erica. Again, this is a little about what the supporter or case manager, we're gonna ensure that the participant understands the whole care pathway. A lot of this will be difficult up front because we're dealing with acute mental issues, but again, working with the client throughout the process, making sure you're explaining each step of the process. Again, understanding how they can communicate decisions both between the court and the client and the supporter. Again, giving the participant the tools, much like we do in the CV 200 program, is we're not enabling or coddling, is but how do we provide the necessary tools, not only to address the immediate needs, but more importantly, the long-going sustainability and stability needs that the client hopefully will have as they exit the program. Again, help with the mental health directive, and then obviously hoping for a graduation and exit into permanent supportive housing, again, which they will still qualify for ongoing services as well. And in this, I'm going to skip over the example per se, but Erica, so you can skip to the next slide, though, because I want to point out one thing, and that we're going to really figure out how we manage this correctly. But say we have this client, Victor, that's gone through the referral process. He's established, we've established a care plan for him. We set up the support systems. But when he gets into the care court journey, at say 6 months, he goes off his medication, relapses, is hospitalized on a 5150 or is back on the streets. He's not immediately exited from the program. What we're going to try and do is really work with him to get him back into treatment and back into the program and gives basically a second. And if we have to, a third chance. What we know about a client like Victor is that if he entered the system for care, he's more than likely to actually enter again. And we have data to prove that on many of our other clients through the programs. So again, it's not like if you fall out of it, then you're just completely done. But can we get you back into the program as well? And then obviously hope for success. Erica, on to the next slide. This is a very lengthy slide about housing. We've had this conversation throughout the meeting today, and we continue to have it. We know that the governor has allocated money for homelessness and housing within the last two fiscal year budgets. So it's really how do we identify building more of those units to Mayor Pro Tem Jonathan's and our point about buying other units, especially since this is going to be really utilizing kind of the crisis stabilization transitional unit. We do see the Navigation Center playing a huge role in this, as well as the recovery centers that behavioral health is developing throughout the county as well. But again, one of the biggest challenges, and I'll get into these in a little bit, is going to be the housing option for this, because it is completely based on a housing first approach. We are looking too at the possibility of how do we look at the voucher system for Section 8. So basically either tenant-based vouchers or project-based vouchers and making those available to these clients for that permanent housing. You can go to the next slide, Erica. This is what if an individual doesn't participate? This is where the teeth can work, but we're a little concerned may not work. And so this is why there were some amendments, both by the Senate and the Assembly, but more importantly, why they decided to not have all 58 counties implement this at once. So they're basically doing two cohorts, and I'll get into that in a minute. But probably the biggest method, I'm going to use the word punishment, I don't want to mean that, but how do we mandate further treatment on that if somebody were to fall out of the program would be to look at a conservatorship position. We know that those are very, very difficult in the current system. What the conversations were in Sacramento, though, is that since the individuals will have gone through this care court program and have already been exposed to the court system, as well as the clinical evaluation on their behavioral health needs, is that those conservatorships may not be as difficult going forward. Again, this is going to take a lot of coordination within the county system between the courts and behavioral health as well. And again, I'll just get back to the fact that if individuals do fall out, they're not precluded from participating in the program in the future. If there were individuals that were tied to any legal proceedings through the criminal justice system, they would be returned to those proceedings as well. I can go to the next slide. Okay. This again is just how it differentiates from the conservatorship program. I've kind of gone over that. So Erica, we can go to the next slide on this. I told you there was a lot of repetition. I apologize. And again, this is just some of the funding. There's been a lot of questions, as I mentioned in the beginning, about this being an unfunded mandate through the governor's office. They are highlighting the investments they've done over the last 2 years in both homelessness and housing funding. There was additional revenue allocated in the budget this year for the program. And then really what the first cohort of counties that are involved are really going to stress and track is what resources do we need extra on top of the current MHSA funding that we have or any of the housing and homeless dollars that we do. We believe the intent of the program is fantastic, but if the state is going to be mandating and holding counties responsible, is they need to make sure that we're provided with the tools to make this successful and not at the expense of our current programming for behavioral health and homeless and housing issues in our other programs as well. And then on next steps, Erica, on the next slide, thank you, Erica. You took the awaiting the governor's signature off the original slide that I had. So we know that he signed that last week. We are awaiting some further implementation guidelines. However, we as a county are having our first working group meeting tomorrow. So this will be for all the relevant departments to start figuring out how we implement the system. And so we're getting a jump on this even before we get full state guidelines and are very excited about the direction that we're going to take. Obviously, looking at some more directives, the funding sources through the Department of Healthcare Services and any additional funding for housing through Housing and Community Development or HCD. The target of implementation date for the first cohort of counties is the October of 2023 or the fall of 2023. And then Riverside has been selected. Actually, we offered to be a cohort or to be around in the first cohort. And then go to the next slide, Erica. So as I had mentioned, we were a little concerned, primarily behavioral health, about the ability for staffing, the ability to get the resources on this. What we decided, though, in conjunction with the executive office, behavioral health, our court system, and Housing and Workforce Solutions Department, that it was better to be part of the first cohort. We believe that we are already building a relatively good infrastructure, one of the best in the state, as far as integrated services between not only our community health centers and behavioral health, but the integration of Department of Public Social Services within that, the integration of behavioral health into our homelessness and housing programs, the development of not only and increasing our behavioral outreach teams, but also the mobile crisis management teams, the amount of investment that we've done into our providers and nonprofit providers in building up their infrastructure. And again, the increase in the supply of affordable housing, a lot of that is not fully opened yet, but we have a larger pipeline than we did 3 years ago. 3 years ago, there were about 50 some odd units under construction in the Coachella Valley. At this point, there's about 800 units already in. So you can see that pipeline happening. With all that being said, is that we really do believe we've got the infrastructure to keep going on that as well. Obviously, the supply of housing is a little bit of concern to us. I did address that as we move forward. And then really some concerns is the behavioral case and case management staff and somewhat court staff. Many of you know that we already have issues with provider shortages at all levels of behavioral services, not only in the Coachella Valley, but in the county as a whole. There are moves to do better for more recruitment, increasing competitive pay for other parts of the state, and also the development of other pipelines for behavioral health specialists and psychiatrists that have been in the works for a few years, but we'll hopefully finally start to see fruition on that. So with that, again, we're excited about the implementation about this, a little scared, but again, I think to address Mayor Pro Tem Johnson's point many, many, many months ago is we really do see this as a tool and as a way for some type of the word enforcement or compelling individuals. Many of you know, and this is my personal belief, is that the ACLU has challenged us on basically human rights and civil rights. I argue, and again, this is a personal opinion, that I think it's worse to treat people. I think it's more a violation of people's civil rights and human rights to leave them dying on the street, especially when they're highly incapacitated mentally or substance use. So again, I think this is going to be a great tool for us to use, and more than happy to answer any questions that I may be able to answer.
Thanks, Greg. I know you went that, through that rather quickly. Are there any questions for Greg? Just a quick question, Greg. On the court system, courts are packed now. Is this going to be a special court? How are they approaching that?
Yeah, so it run a lot like the model that we do already for our veterans court, our family preservation courts. You usually have specific judges that are assigned to those. And again, we're still kind of waiting for some of the implementation guidelines on the court process. There will definitely have to be both, you know, reshuffling of duties within the court system now, or actually hiring additional judges or, you know, public defenders or DA positions for that.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks for that. Okay, we'll move on to item number D, 6D, the election of our committee officers. Erica?
Yes, thank you, Chair, for that. The election of committee officers, many of you have served on CVAC's committees and know this is our annual activity. Our chair this year is Councilmember Christy Holsage, and our vice chair and chair today is Councilmember John Pena. We did reach out to Chair Holsage. She has asked not to be considered and supports a change in leadership. So with that, we will open the floor for nominations.
Mr. Vice Chair, with your permission, I think traditionally we have rotated the vice chair into the chair's position. And your investment in this committee, your background, your experience more than amply justifies that we follow that tradition. So I'd like to nominate John Pena for chair and leave it to the rest of the group to consider a vice chair.
I second the nomination for chair.
I would completely agree with that. And I know Mayor Wayman Furman has quite a passion for this. And I would like to nominate him for vice chair.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have, are there any more nominations? Okay, we have two nominations. Erica, how do you want to handle this? Take a vote?
We could take that, if there is a motion on the floor, we could take that as one, or we could break that up into second, whatever the committee's preference is.
Okay, so we have two nominations. How do you want to do that? Up to you.
I'll amend my motion to include John Pena for chair and Wayman Furman for vice chair.
Second.
There's a motion and a second.
And then you could just call for
the vote. Okay, we'll call for a vote on that. All in favor, please vote.
Aye.
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 Are there any no's? Any abstentions? Seeing none? Congratulations, Chair.
Thank you. Okay, well, no further record that that has occurred. Thank you all. We look forward to moving forward as well. Item number 7 is informational. Are there any questions on any of the informational items? Okay. And Erica, I didn't see where we usually have ad hoc people that want to do any kind of comments. Is there anybody that wishes to do a comment from the ad, or not ad hoc, from our partners?
Our ex officios?
Ex officios.
Yes, that's okay. We can ask if there are ex officio members who would like to raise their hand. I know we have a hand in the gallery. I believe that's for public comment, though.
Okay.
I don't see any for ex officio updates.
Okay, great. If not, then we'll move on to the public comment. And you have a hand raised?
Yes, we'll bring her in. We will. Host, can we bring in Walker Beverly? Oh, there she is.
I don't have anything to say today. Hi, everyone. I don't have anything to say.
Okay. Chair, I do not see any other hands raised for public comments, and we did not receive any written.
Okay, thank you. If not, we'll move on to item 9, the announcements of our next upcoming meeting, which will be November 16th at 10 a.m. via Zoom. And the executive committee meeting will be held on Monday, September 26th at 4:30 via Zoom. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
You can just adjourn.
Okay, yeah. We can just adjourn. We are adjourned. Thank you all.
Thank you, Chair. Bye, everyone.
Thank you.